This time on your weekly constitutional.
But my first year students at UVM, as it's called, also amazed me by what they knew about our past that never happened, and the important things that did happen that they never heard of. And so I came to realize that really bad history was a national problem, and that's what led to my fascination with, shall we say, history as a weapon, and that led to lies my teacher told me.
That was James Loewen, the best-selling author of a number of books on American history. Perhaps the best-known of those books is Lies My Teacher Told Me, which came out over 20 years ago and which is now being reissued. My name is Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Stay tuned for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
People who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. So wrote James Madison in a letter on August 4th, 1822. It seems self-evident, doesn't it, that if you're going to have a democratic society, that we, the people, need to know what we're voting on before we vote on it. We need to know what we're talking about before we open our mouths. And yet somehow, in this era of alternative facts and the very denial of the existence of objective truth, well, Madison's words ring truer than ever. And so it's with great pleasure that I noticed recently that James Loewen, the author of a number of best-selling books, is now reissuing perhaps the most prominent of all of them. It came out back in the 1990s. It's called Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong.
I'm Jim Loewen. I'm a sociologist, but I mostly write about and think about American history.
Well, that's an interesting segue. What prompted you to segue from sociology to history?
It was actually my first full-time teaching job, which was at Tougaloo College, just a little bit south of you in Mississippi. Matter of fact, I drove the length of Tennessee from Bristol to down near Memphis in order to get there.
You drove right past us, Jim. Next time you do that, I want you to stop and say hello to Wayne and me.
Okay.
All right.
So anyway, Tougaloo is a good college. It's an African-American college. It's a small college, so most people haven't heard of it, even as nearby as Tennessee. But I enjoyed my life there. I taught there for 7 years. My first year, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also asked to teach and did teach one section of a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. Now, this was a course required of all first-year students. It was invented by the history department. It introduced students to, you know the drill, poli-sci, soc, anthro, psych, econ. And it did this in the context of African-American history, which made perfect sense because 99% of our students were African-American. Well, African-American history follows the same chronology, of course, as what we might call regular American history. So the second semester begins not only right after Christmas, but also right after the Civil War. I had 17 new students. I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class. So I asked them, what is this period called Reconstruction? What images come to your mind about that? And what happened might be called an aha moment for me, but it might better be called an oh no moment. Because what happened was 16 of my 17 students said, well, Reconstruction was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states. But they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again.
This is a group of African-American students who are telling you this?
All of them. And
oh, dear.
As your dismay indicates, that's terrible. I mean, first of all, there's at least three direct lies in that sentence. Black folks never took over the government of the southern states. All of the southern states had white governors throughout. All but one had a white legislative majority. Second of all, the Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they wrote much better state constitutions than the constitutions they had had before or that they labor under today. They did all kinds of interesting things, passed a homestead tax exemption law, etc. Mississippi, in particular, had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century. And then the concept of too soon out of slavery. Now, there's a concept as if slavery was an educational institution. Here it was a felony to teach black folks to read or write. So my little heart sank. And I thought, my gosh, what must it do to you to believe that the one time your group was center stage on American history, they screwed up? Now, if it's true, that's another matter. You have to come to terms with that, have to understand this, what's going on. But it is not true. It's what we in sociology call an example of BS. That's bad sociology. And by the way, I said 16 out of 17. The one exception, he was in such a tiny minority that he was quite cowed. He said, gee, I didn't think it was so bad. Didn't they start the public schools and stuff? Which they did. So I said, well, where did you go to school? Hoping that somewhere in the state of Mississippi there was a teacher who deviated from the norm. And he replied, and most of our students were from Mississippi, he replied, Gary, Indiana.
Oh, my.
So I went to nearby schools, and this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South. This would have been January 1969. I went to nearby schools, and I literally watched as black teachers taught their all-black classes white supremacist history because they were just teaching what was in the book, particularly in the course Mississippi history, which was required in fifth grade and then required again in ninth grade. So I realized that what we had to do was write a different book. And for about a year and a half, I tried to get historians to do that, but they were too busy with their own projects. So finally, I got a grant, and I put together a batch of students and faculty at Tougaloo and also at Millsaps College, the nearby white school, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi for that course. Well, the book was acclaimed. In fact, it won the number one award for Southern literature called the Lillian Smith Award. But the state of Mississippi rejected it. And like Tennessee, Mississippi is a statewide adoption state. But I will say this, Tennessee adopts almost every book that reads on the right grade level and is on the subject and is bound okay. Alabama used to, anyway, I don't know if they still do, they used to accept just one book per subject. Mississippi typically accepted 3 to 5 books. And in Mississippi history, they only had two. We might call it ours and theirs. And by a 2-to-5 margin, they rejected our book. There were 2 blacks and 5 whites on that adoption committee. I think you can do the math. Mm. So we eventually ended up suing them. And the lawsuit is, in fact, called Lowen et al. Versus Turnip Seed et al.
Oh, yes, my. What a great title.
There are people in Mississippi named Turnip Seed. You picked up on it. I got to choose the lead defendant, subject to the requirement that he or she needed to be in the Northern District. That's because the Southern, you know, Mississippi is a long state the way Tennessee is, although you're east-west. And so Mississippi is divided into 2 federal districts. And Jackson is in the Southern District, but the lead defendant locates a suit. And the Southern District was overrun with particularly terrible and racist judges that had been appointed by Nixon and by Kennedy. And the Northern District had some halfway decent judges that were appointed by Eisenhower and by Johnson, which is interesting.
This is some pretty significant legal analysis that you're going through here. Do you have a legal background, too, or was this just a good lawyer who was advising you?
No, my only legal background is I've been an expert witness in maybe 50 to 100 cases by now.
But all of this stuff is the stuff I try to teach my students about carefully selecting your defendant and figuring out things like venue and judges.
Well, I have to say it wasn't that careful. That is to say, I had to pick a defendant in the Northern District, but I had 3, maybe even 4 choices, and I picked Turnipseed because of his name. and I screwed up because, you know, if you think about it, Brown v. Board of Education, everybody calls it what?
Brown.
Of course. Everybody calls Plessy v. Ferguson what?
Plessy.
And what do you think they call Lowen v. Turnipseed?
I'm guessing turnip seed.
Of course.
Well, that's okay.
I lost my 15 seconds of fame.
You weren't in it for the fame, I'm sure.
Well, that's true. What we then had, it was fascinating. For a week, we put on all kinds of expert witnesses and local Mississippi witnesses. And they all argued, for example, an anthropologist argued that our book was much better in its treatment of Choctaw Indians than their book. We had a professor of literature at Ole Miss who argued that our book was much better in its treatment of Mississippi literary greats such as Faulkner than their book, et cetera, et cetera. But after that week, which was one of the nicest weeks of my life, imagine a whole week of people doing nothing but saying nice things about your work, then the state had their chance. And in fact, John Turnipseed was on the stand when the dramatic moment of the trial came. He was asked by the Assistant Attorney General for the state, why did you reject this book? And he had us turn to, I think it was page 139, wherever it is, that there's a photo of a lynching. It's not an egregious photo. It shows a man being burned to death in outline in a fire, and it shows a bunch of well-dressed men and women behind the fire. And it gets across the meaning of the word lynching, because the key thing about a lynching is that it's a public murder done with no trepidation, often done by pillars of the community like these folks. And they are willing to be photographed while committing this felony because they know nothing's going to be done about it. And that's, of course, what's so important about a lynching in the first place. So Turnipseed is on the stand, and he has us turn to this page. And I committed to memory what he then said. He said, quote, "Now, you know, some ninth graders, especially black male ninth graders, are pretty big. And we worried, or at least I worried, that teachers, especially white lady teachers, might have trouble controlling their classes with material like this in the book. Well, we had pre-tested our book with an overwhelmingly white class and with an overwhelmingly black class, and they both liked it, all the pieces, better than their book. So we had material for rebuttal testimony on this point, but we didn't have to use it because at that moment, the judge, who was an 83-year-old white Mississippian, but a man of honor, Orma Smith, he took over the questioning. And he said, and I quote, but that happened, didn't it? Didn't Mississippi have more lynchings than any other state? And Turnipseed replied, well, yes, but that all happened so long ago. Why dwell on it now? And the judge said, well, it is a history book. And we poked each other and said, we're going to win this case. And we did win the case. Our book was ordered adopted by the state for the usual 6-year period, and some districts adopted it. But that whole escapade taught me that history can be a weapon and that it can be used against you and that it had been used against my students. I left Tougaloo after 7 years. I went to the University of Vermont. I claim I've been that I taught at the blackest and the whitest schools in America, and I think I did. But my first-year students at UVM, as it's called, also amazed me by what they knew about our past that never happened, and the important things that did happen that they never heard of. And so I came to realize that really bad history was not a Mississippi problem. It was a national problem. History as a weapon was a national problem. Mississippi exemplified this problem in a more exaggerated form, as it exemplified various other social problems in a more exaggerated form, but it was a national problem. And that's what led to my fascination with, shall we say, history as weapon, and that led to Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Which is a remarkable book. Which we've never had the chance to talk about on this show, so I'm just so thrilled that it's been reissued. And it is a huge bestseller. In fact, isn't it among the biggest bestsellers in your field?
Yes, I think it's true, that it's the best-selling book by a living sociologist. When I'm given a lecture, I say, other sociologists have done better, but they are dead.
Well, I'm glad you're still with us, and I'm glad it's selling so well. Well, first of all, tell me about the process of writing the book and how you approached it, and we'll go on and talk about what's actually in it.
Well, we we focused on telling the truth. That's the first thing. There were a total of maybe 8 authors, as I mentioned, students and faculty. And we set up kind of a checklist of things that you have to make sure you covered. Have you included all the groups that should be covered? What kinds of research have you done? Have you looked at primary sources and so on? We also set up somebody to edit every chapter, and that somebody to edit was always myself or my main co-editor, Charles Salas, who is a professor of Southern history at Millsaps College, for any of the students. We never had a student editing another student. But we did have students editing us. As a result, I think the book reads as one entity. It doesn't read like it's constructed by 8 different people.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our guest is James Loewen, the author of a number of books, perhaps most notably Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's just been reissued by the New Press, and it's a fascinating read. After the break, we'll continue our discussion with Jim. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week we're talking with Jim Loewen, the author of a number of books, including Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. I was asking Jim how he came to do this, how he came to write such a remarkable book. And it turns out it happened a number of years ago when he was in Mississippi, and he realized that the Mississippi history books he was teaching didn't get it right. Jim's book on Mississippi history, which he wrote with several faculty and student collaborators, got it right.
It's different in many other ways. I mean, I'll give you just a simple way. At the time we wrote the book, and the book came out in 1974, at the time we wrote it, women were always referred to with courtesy titles. That is, even usually on the first use of their word, of their name, and always in any second use. In other words, it would be Mrs. Hillary Clinton ran for president, and they didn't use Ms. back then. And if they ever did say Hillary Clinton ran for president, then the next time they would say Ms. Clinton's campaign instead of Clinton's campaign. Well, we didn't do that. We were the first. That's the first place I know in print. And of course, nobody does that now. Just little things like that. We included about 30 maps. So, and we asked students to look at, to compare these maps. I particularly remember we had an exercise which compared the distribution of slaves in Mississippi in 1850 with the distributions of votes for the incredibly racist Senator James O. Eastland in 1950. And damn if the two maps didn't overlap pretty much, which of course does not show that slaves voted for Eastland. Slaves never voted, and in 1950, black folks were not voting in Mississippi. But it did show that the people who came from a slavery area voted for Eastland. And you can then think about what's the mechanism that caused that 100 years later. So there were a lot of pedagogical things that it did. It never asked at the end of chapters these 55 questions that our American history textbooks still ask. You know, my favorite is, when did the War of 1812 start? But, you know, whatever. The questions in our book were fascinating.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, when you got up to Vermont and you recognized this was a nationwide problem, that's when you decided to write Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Yeah, or at least I started to think about it, yes.
Okay.
I didn't really get it done until the 1990s. And the Smithsonian, I need to give credit to the Smithsonian, the National Museum of American History, which is one of the big three of the Smithsonian museums, had, I think they still have, a bunch of postdoctoral fellowships. And I won one. I was so excited. And so that gave me a year at the Smithsonian to do nothing but talk with those folks. And of course, who is presenting people history to the people more than the National Museum of American History, you know. So these people had thought about how to present history. They hadn't always done it right, but they sometimes had, and they were well worth talking with. And so that's when I accomplished a lot of the writing, and then it finally got finished in 1994.
So this sounds like close to a 20-year process then.
Yeah, it took me, it certainly took 11 years of the last footnote in the book. I'm kind of proud of that footnote because in the when the first edition came out, I said, well, after 11 years of research, because it took me 11 years working, not full time, I mean, I was teaching school, but it was the thing I was working on for 11 years, which is a very long time for a book, even by an academician. And the reason it took so long was because the last thing I wanted to do was to make a bunch of mistakes in a book that criticizes yeah. textbooks for making a bunch of mistakes.
Yeah, you got to be careful when you're being critical.
So I said, after these 11 years, footnote, and then the last footnote says, well, I also did other things. But anyway, after all these years, I'm still just beginning my quest to learn everything we got wrong in American history. And I'm glad that this new edition came out because now I can talk about some more things we're getting on.
We'll get to that in just a minute because you've got a rather incisive introduction to this new edition. But before we get there, how did you decide on which lies you were going to focus on debunking?
Well, I'm not sure. Obviously, I did have a collection of 12 U.S. history textbooks that are used in high school. So that gave me a bedrock of what is actually being taught in these books. And I found a couple of surprises. I found, for example, that slavery was taught halfway decently. It wasn't taught as a great system that benefited the slave and got him out of Africa and was just really a nice thing. And it wasn't that. I mean, slavery was really something to be endured at best. And I can go on and on about that. So therefore, I didn't end up writing a chapter saying slavery is really terrible. What I did is I would read what the books say about a given subject. Instead of reading book number one all the way through and then book number two all the way through, I would read what all of them said, let's say, about Columbus. Mm-hmm. And then I'd see, well, was there a pattern there? What did they tell me? What did they not tell me? And just for the record, about Columbus, there was a terrible pattern. They told me a bunch of stuff that mostly didn't happen. Then they left out everything important. Some of the most important things that happened in the last 500 years, Columbus brought about, and they didn't tell us about that. So, therefore, I concluded, well, I got to have a chapter about Columbus.
I remember reading about Columbus. That was quite an awakening because, of course, most of us, when I was growing up in the 60s and the 70s, you got at best neutral and for the most part, a generally positive introduction to him because he was the quote unquote discoverer of America and in some sense. Right. I mean, that's basically the story everybody got. Yeah. But you point out that that's not exactly true.
Well, my Columbus chapter is deliberately titled 1493. The real significance of Christopher Columbus. Because if you think about it, in 1492, he didn't do nothing that those Vikings hadn't done about 400 years earlier, 500 years earlier. Namely, reach America. They had actually gone around for about 2 years living on what's now Newfoundland, maybe even living some other places, definitely visiting a bunch of other places. And so they knew about America. They knew about the native people. They had trouble with them after they treated them badly and got treated badly in return. And Columbus did that in his first voyage. But in his second voyage, Columbus did something absolutely new, never been done on the planet before. And that is he took 17 ships and 1,000 to 2,000 soldiers. He took people in armor. He took, worst of all, these fighting dogs that tore people apart. He took horses. He took cannon. And he proceeded to conquer the entire island of Haiti, even renamed it Little Spain or Hispaniola, which it remains named to this day. That had never been done before. Nobody had ever conquered another place, ocean away. And, of course, that led to the same thing in Mexico, the same thing in Peru, the same thing throughout the Americas, and completely changed world history. Well, that's not what they focus on. The textbooks focus everything on his 1492. Some of them even tell or still imply that he proved the world round. And this is so ridiculous. I mean, it is round. I'm not arguing that.
Well, I'm glad we're clear on that.
Yes. But the idea... Every sailor in the world already knew that the world was round. If you just think about it, ships disappear over the horizon just listen to the words. As the roundness of the world gets in the way, they don't become littler and littler and littler until finally they're just a little dot, and then the dot disappears. No, first you can't see the hull, and then you can't see the sails, and finally you can't see the little flag up on top. And every sailor understood that. So here they are making stuff up about the near mutiny of the crew, all kinds of BS, instead of telling us what he set in motion in his second trip, which, among other things, let me go off on this for a minute,
sure,
is the Columbian Exchange.
Yeah.
Now, everybody listening who's under the age of 20 has heard of the Columbian Exchange. But those people that are over the age of 40 probably haven't, because it was completely left out of all the textbooks until the late 1990s after my book came out. And my book taught it to some of them. I personally taught it to one historian who had written an American history textbook. The Columbian Exchange is the process whereby stuff from one continent gets over onto other continents and influences them, even an ocean away. And by stuff, I mean crops. So we get, for example, corn and potatoes and tomatoes going from the Americas to Europe. And this causes a revolution in the power structure of Europe, because it causes a population explosion in Northern Europe, because corn and especially potatoes can be grown where it's cold. And so the dominant countries in Europe had been Italy and Spain, and also Turkey. Now they became England, France, Germany, and Russia, and they still are. And that's caused by the Columbian Exchange. Another part of the exchange was disease germs, which mostly went from Eurasia, Africa, which is one connected continent, if you think about it, over to the Americas. And so the population of native people in the Americas gets wiped down by 90 to 95% by the flu, by cowpox, smallpox, etc., which they had no experience with. And then there's the intellectual exchange. Ideas about how to run governments go especially from west to east, that is, go from the Americas, because pundits in Western Europe are astounded to find rather large areas of land, such as the Choctaw Empire, or it shouldn't be called empire, the Choctaw area, the Iroquois League, and so on, that are being run efficiently and okay without any kings. And they didn't know how to do that. So ideas about democracy go from west to east. Ideas about Christianity go from east to west. All kinds of things are now going in both directions. And we still, you know, I live in D.C., where about 10 or 15 years ago, we got another visitor from across the ocean. I'm talking about the snakehead carp, which...
That's a scary-looking fish.
The Chesapeake, you know, estuary, and now that's what you catch. So this Columbian Exchange continues, and it's the most important thing to happen on the planet in the last 500 years. And it wasn't mentioned in the textbooks.
You know what, Jim, that I didn't learn about that. I'm over 40, well over 40. I did not learn about this in school. I learned about it as an adult, and I think that you're the one who taught it to me.
Yeah, could be. I've taught it to a lot of people.
Yeah, extremely important. And of all these sorts of things are so much more interesting than the myth that he proved the world to be round.
Oh, actually, it would be a good story if only it were true.
If it were true. I think I saw that
I'm
on Looney.
I'm afraid of sailing off the edge.
I saw that on Looney Tunes, that he proved the earth was round. Tell me one more thing about Columbus, and that is his treatment of the people he conquered.
Oh, yeah. Well, right off the bat, he says in his journal, he says they're kind of estimable. He likes them. He thinks they're strong and well-built and intelligent and so on. They help him. One of his ships, you know, runs aground. I think it's the Santa Maria. And they help get everything off it. And then they put up his crew, some of the crew, because he doesn't want to take them all back in the two remaining ships, which are smaller than the Santa Maria in the first place. So he kind of likes them. But then pretty soon, on that very first trip, he realizes they don't got no significant weapons. They're not really very good at war. He said, with 50 warriors, I could run the whole place. I could dominate the whole island. So he comes back not with 50, but with between 1,000 and 2,000, and does just that. And now he starts emphasizing that they're lazy, that they're slothful, that they're not Christian, of course. And this is his excuse for enslaving them. So on the very first trip, he takes at least seven, I think he took maybe a dozen, back as slaves to Spain. Seven of them made it alive, and they're curiosities, and he shows them off in Spain. But pretty soon, he starts the transatlantic slave trade, only he starts it from west to east. He starts it with Arawak Indians, and he enslaves over 1,000 of them in one big slave raid, and picks the 500 best ones and takes them across. In all, he shipped 5,000 enslaved native people to the Canary Islands and to Spain itself.
And that's just fascinating.
But they died from these diseases. And then his son starts the same process in the other direction with black folks from Africa.
I didn't realize Christopher Columbus's son was involved before your book. Yeah. Quite a family. So everything's backward. I mean, we always think of the slave trade as being, as you say, from east to west, from Africa to the Americas. It started in the Americas and it went the other way to begin with. And then finally, my understanding has been that Caribbean slavery, slavery in the lower part of the Americas, was probably the cruelest and most difficult type of slavery.
It certainly caused the wiping out of the population on Haiti and on some of the other islands. It was just terrible. The disease was, of course, a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
But so was what we would now call the deculturation of the natives. They were just so harshly put down. They actually had to carry Spaniards. Spaniards bragged that they never had to walk a step on Haiti. They would have a native carry them. Also deculturated them in terms of their agriculture. They made them grow Spanish crops, which weren't good for them. They made them mine gold, and if they didn't do a good enough job and come up with either enough gold or enough cotton cloth, then they would get their hand chopped off as a threat to the others so that they would do better. So pretty soon, the population of Haiti, which had started, there's a lot of different estimates, but I think the best estimate would be about 3 million. The population of Haiti goes to about zero. That is, almost all native people. There's a few people who intermarried and then had children, and they didn't all die. But the population goes to just about zero. It's just about complete genocide. It wasn't all on purpose. In fact, the Spanish then started raiding the Bahamas and other islands somewhat near Haiti and bringing people over to be slaves in Haiti because all their slaves had died. So it wasn't exactly on purpose, but it was still just utterly gruesome.
It is a gruesome tale. Tell me a happier tale. I mean, you've got lots of them in your book. Something we got wrong that wasn't quite as depressing as the way Christopher Columbus treated the natives.
Well, you know, we are now in the 150th anniversary, the sesquicentennial, if you will, of Reconstruction. And if we forget about what my students parroted back to me at Tougaloo College about Reconstruction, Reconstruction was an interesting period, full of promise. African-American historian writes about it that it showed that for 10 years or so, the United States actually tried democracy. And we really did. And it was working pretty well. In fact, that's why the white ex-Confederates were so avid to try to destroy it and to end it, because they wanted to reimpose racial hierarchy. And they did reimpose racial hierarchy. But for maybe 10 years, I mean, just for example, this state senator, I think he was, from Yazoo City, Mississippi, white state senator, fell in love with a black woman in Mississippi who was originally from New York. I don't know what she was doing down there. Maybe she was teaching school. She was said to be utterly beautiful. He married her, and he got reelected. Well,
really?
It's not at all clear that even today a white person can marry a black woman, even, if I'm going to say this, I'm going to say it, even a beautiful black woman, mm-hmm. and get reelected to the Mississippi legislature, you know?
Well, that's a much happier tale.
Yeah, there we go.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a perfectly delightful conversation with a fellow who's been on the show several times before. His name is James Loewen. He's written books called Lies Across America, Sundown Towns, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, all of which we've discussed in the show and all of which you can find on our podcast site. Today, we're talking about perhaps his most prominent book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with Jim Lowen, the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. It turns out this was not just a bestseller, but it's had quite an impact on American education. Now, tell me what the reaction was to your book over the last 20 years. Did you get a lot of blowback from people?
Not really. Well, certainly from some. Historians like it, especially historians from the period. That is to say, historians of the Civil War think that my two chapters that treat the Civil War and Reconstruction are spot on. They're going to learn a whole bunch of stuff, and they did learn a whole bunch of stuff about, say, Columbus, because history is unfortunately, like most academic disciplines, so specialized that you can, you know, spend your life as a Civil War historian and you don't know nothing about 1840, to say nothing of 1540, you know, and what the United States was like then. In each area, I haven't gotten any significant criticism from the historians who know that area, that era, that topic. From teachers, there's been a little blowback from the title, and I don't blame them. I mean, it sounds terrible, Lies My Teacher Told Me. The subtitle helps a little bit. It says everything your American history textbook got wrong, and there's a little tension between those two. So I used to start all my talks for teachers with kind of a 30-second or 60-second apology for the title. But it was actually a couple of teachers who taught me not to do that. He said, look, if we're just retailing what's in the textbook, then we are lying. So let's get on with the lesson here. And so I don't do that anymore. But the book is not teacher bashing. The book points out, first of all, that the best teachers teach history, and they use the textbook as a tool for teaching history, and sometimes they teach against the textbook. And that's a great way to get students involved. So, on the whole, teachers love the book. I mean, when I go to someplace like the National Council for the Social Studies, which is a batch of K-12 teachers in the area of social studies and history, no matter how big a room they put me in, it's always full. And people are there ahead of time to make sure they get a seat, and I have just the best time. It's great to have a choir, you know. I understand the concept of preaching to the choir is kind of useless because I already know everything, but it's still fun.
Absolutely, it's still fun. Well, I'm glad to hear then that it was basically positive. It certainly had a positive effect.
Let me give you an example from just 3 years ago of both positive and negative, because there's still the negative, and I didn't mention anything negative, and I should. About 3 years ago, I was recruited by a school system to give a workshop. This is in far northwestern Wisconsin. And I did. I went there. I gave a workshop. It drew also a bunch of people from Duluth, Minnesota, which is right nearby. And it was a well-attended workshop. And the school system had me on purpose because they think that I'm getting students thinking about history and helping teachers get beyond the textbook. And they love the book, and they got their teachers all to come. Well, a teacher came from an adjoining district right next door in northwestern Wisconsin. And he came without any support from his school system. Indeed, he told me if his school system knew that he was there, he would be in trouble for it.
Oh, my.
Right? And so that's two different districts right next door to each other. So you can never predict. But some districts still want students to be taught what's in the book. And America was always great, and we never did nothing wrong. And if you say different, I'm going to hit you upside the head with this 1,150-page textbook.
You know, I'm going to tell you something, Jim, that's completely consistent with what you've been saying. I, of course, am fascinated by history. I'm fascinated by your books. We talk about constitutional history all the time on this show. But in high school, it was one of my least favorite subjects, American history.
Of course.
And it was because the book was bland, the book was boring. And get this, now, my teacher would actually just read it to us.
Oh, God.
She would stand in the front of the class, she might paraphrase occasionally. But, I mean, if you were looking at the book, you knew what she was going to say next because she was just reading it.
That is actually even worse than my teacher. And I sometimes hold up Lies My Teacher Told Me and say, I could have subtitled this book Revenge Against Coach DeMolin, because he was my teacher, and he was, of course, the basketball coach. And this happened across the Midwest, across the South. Texas especially has all these teachers. I mean, there's not enough PE classes to go around, right? And so you can't, there's so many coaches, you know, if you have a football team, well, you got to have a coach, you got to have an assistant coach, you got to have a JV coach, that's for the junior varsity, maybe you got a separate freshman team, so that you got to have three or four coaches just for football. And there's not enough PE classes, physical education classes. So what are they going to teach? Well, you can't have them teaching English or the students will all come out illiterate, you know, and even they don't think they can ever teach math. So let's have them teach something that doesn't matter. That's the thinking of the school district, you know.
Yep.
And so for the teachers who do care about history and social studies, they're completely demoralized by this policy. And of course, the teachers who are the coaches first and foremost, they're terrible. And Coach DeMolin, the only thing he had us do was answer all those 55 questions at the end of each chapter. And then he would give us a test, which came from those same questions, you know. And they're all these multiple choice, stupid question things that are just terrible.
My teacher would give us a study sheet before each test.
Yeah.
And all you needed to do was memorize it.
Yeah.
And then you spit it back out. And on one occasion, I recall I missed a question and she was astonished. And she said, but didn't you memorize the sheet? Apparently not completely. It was terrible.
You should write that up as an article. That's even worse than.
It was pretty darn bad. It was pretty darn bad. But hey, this is a reissue, and you've written a new introduction, and it brings the book up to date, or at least place it in the current context. So tell us about that, please.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, Lies My Teacher Told Me is even more important than it used to be, and I am making a comment, unfortunately, that relates to our current administration. We do have the problem that some people think we're in a post-truth era, an era of alternative facts and so on, an era when everybody gets their own news, if you will. I mean, you can listen to MSNBC if you're on the left. You can listen to Fox if you're on the right. There's some outlets that are way to the right of Fox or way to the left of MSNBC. We used to have more sources, including the big daily newspaper of a town, that reached everybody. But, of course, newspaper circulations are way down, and as a result, their staffs are down, and so they're doing less journalism. And so everything is opinion now, and almost nothing is fact. And I strapped this on in this new introduction. In fact, the very first picture or pictures is a pair of pictures showing the famous crowds at a guy named President Obama's first inauguration and a guy named President Trump's so far only inauguration. And these two pictures are side by side. They're absolutely identically posed. That is, what's on the right is on the right in both pictures, and they're exactly the same place. And you could literally see all kinds of the ground for Trump's crowd, whereas that area is completely filled with people for Obama's crowd. This hopefully will get students thinking about alternative facts and realize there's no such thing. There's either a factual basis for what you're saying or there isn't. And so we got to go back to it and we have to read critically. And so the whole point of my new introduction is to get the reader started thinking critically and reading critically. And I also do something else there, which is probably going to get me in some trouble. I say that historians in the academy play some role in this problem, because we, and I am a member of the Organization of American Historians, even though I'm a sociologist, so we have made such a sophisticated hash out of the notion of truth that it becomes useless. I remember the phrase that we now say in graduate school. I heard this at the Smithsonian when I was writing Lies My Teacher Told Me. Why should we privilege one narrative above others with the term true? It's kind of like every narrative is useful, and we just want the most useful one, or we want one that's useful for the question of feminism, or we want one that's useful for the question of social class, or whatever. Well, I would reply, right. And the Civil War started in 1875 in Nevada. It grew out of a pay dispute between the Chinese workers and the Union Pacific Railroad. And people would look at me as if I was crazy and say, but that's not true. And of course, it isn't true. It's the wrong place, the wrong time, the wrong cause. And I would say, bingo. And then they would say, well, that's too easy. Well, it is. But there's all kinds of other issues that are just as easy if you really do the work. For example, why did the Southern states secede? Well, they seceded about slavery. First, second, and third, that's what they tell us. They did not secede for states' rights. Indeed, they were against states' rights, and they list the states and they list the rights that really upset them, that caused them to secede. So sometimes this even-handed stuff of, well, here's one position and here's the other position, is simply BS.
That's a pretty important point you make, Jim, because it's one thing for a bunch of historians who are at an academic conference to talk about nuance and to talk about different perspectives and to recognize that we didn't have video cameras running all throughout history, and therefore, yes, we're looking at different narratives and trying to come towards something called objective truth and probably falling short. And that's an academic discussion, and that's fine. But then that gets translated into, oh, well, it's all opinion.
Yeah.
And my opinion's as good as yours.
That's right.
And there's no such thing as objective truth. And that's a very frightening subject.
And of course, you can always find a website to back up your opinion.
Yep.
And so it's a very simple thing that teachers can do about this. And that is they can ask their students when they cite whatever they cite, whether it's the textbook or a website or a really good work of history in the library or whatever, whatever they cite, the question is, why is this credible? And, of course, a KKK website may be absolutely credible if the question is, what does the KKK think about secession? If the question is, why did the Southern states secede, then a KKK website is not so credible.
Right.
And students can, but just by being forced to answer that question, they start thinking critically all by themselves.
Well, Jim, I run into the same problem with some of my law students, and they push back occasionally because, you know, of course, by this age, they're in their 20s and they've been fed this nonsense their entire lives. And they don't like it when you point out that perhaps the sources they've been citing are not that credible. But it's important work. And in my own little way, I try to do it as well. I can only stand in awe of your great contribution to the cause of truth in American history. And we didn't have a chance today to speak about your other book that you've reissued, Sundown Towns, but I will simply mention to people that we did a whole episode on that several years ago. So if they're interested in that book as well, they can go to our podcast site or iTunes or Spotify or wherever they get our podcast and simply enter into the search bar Sundown Towns, and they should bring that podcast up. But in the meantime, congratulations on the reissue of both that and Lies My Teacher Told Me, and I hope you sell millions more copies.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you, as always.
Once again, it's our favorite time of the show. It's time for a constitutional quiz. And with me is Emily Voss of James Madison's Montpelier, also known as the Quiz Gal. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Stuart.
Do you have some tough, tough quizzes for us today?
I do. I always do.
I know. You're kind of a tough, tough woman. In fact, you were a teacher for a while, weren't you?
Well, for a very short time, but that was preschool students, so it's a different.
And the story,
you come
story
off as
I
tough in a different way to
so
5-year-olds.
Mean to them that you made them cry, and that's why it was such a short. Do we have a contestant for the Quiz Gal?
Yes, I am.
Who is this?
My name is Tay Takaneka. I'm from Salinas, California. I'm a special education teacher. I actually used to listen to WETS.
Were you at ETSU? Is that where you went to college?
Yes, I was.
Oh, so you picked this up on the local radio on our home station, but now you've moved out to Salinas?
Yeah, I got my teaching license in Tennessee, and I came to California to teach.
Now, I don't think we have a station in Salinas, so I'm guessing you listen to us over the internet.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Well, we're so pleased to have you with us, and in fact, I will mention that Tay is among our more frequent commenters on our Facebook page, which is a great deal of fun. So I already feel like I know you, Tay. In fact, I think I've invited you on several occasions to sign up for a quiz, and that this was the first time that you actually felt you were ready for it.
Yeah. there's been a couple of times in the past, but as I work as a teacher during the day, so now it's my summer vacation, and I'm ready to contest.
Well, we're ready for you. Emily, let's give Tay a good question, shall we?
All right. So my question for you, Tay, is what was the condition that had to be provided in order for anti-federalists to accept the Constitution? A, a list of unalienable rights. B, an oath of allegiance. C, a declaration of grievances. or D, a Bill of Rights.
Okay, let me make sure I understand that. So the Federalists wanted the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists did not.
The Anti-Federalists had serious reservations about the Constitution as presented by Madison and the Framers.
That's right. And so there was a condition upon which the Anti-Federalists agreed to ratify. Is that what we're looking for?
That is correct. So what was that condition?
Okay. And what were the choices again?
Choice A, a list of unalienable rights. B, an oath of allegiance. C, a declaration of grievances. Or D, a Bill of Rights.
Tay?
I think I know the answer. Maybe Emily gave me a easier question because she used to be teacher too.
Well, what's the answer, Tay? We'll see if it's easy or not.
I think it's D, the Bill of Rights.
You don't like any of the other answer choices?
Well, not that I don't like it, but I think, you know, the Anti-Federalists are all for states' rights, and one of the things that the Bill of Rights secured was states' rights and limitation of federal government. So.
Well, Emily, is Tay correct? Was it choice D, a Bill of Rights?
You bet. Yep. A Bill of Rights was that condition.
Tremendous. Well done, Tay. You see, your confidence was justified. That was an extremely important compromise because, as Emily can tell you, well, Madison didn't want a Bill of Rights at first, did he, Emily?
That is accurate, yeah. So Madison and others had the opinion that if you listed out individual rights, then that would indicate that those were the only rights that you were entitled to. So if you somehow missed one, did that mean that you didn't have that particular right? So Madison was reluctant to include one, but in order to get all the states to agree to pass the Constitution, he eventually caved and framed out the Bill of Rights as well.
Yeah, he did. And I think that that's probably, from a purely political standpoint, sure, compromise. Madison was a great compromiser. He was a great politician. He understood these things. But I think he also perhaps philosophically came around to the idea that a Bill of Rights might be a good idea if for no other reason than to educate people as to what their rights were. Because if you don't know what your rights are, at least some of your most basic rights, then how can you ever defend them? How can you ever protect them? And indeed, that's, of course, why we've touched upon this on several times on this show. In fact, why we do this show entirely in all of our educational efforts, including the excellent teacher seminars that Emily runs, are designed to make people aware of those rights. So in that manner, at least, we agree very strongly with James Madison, as we agree with him on many issues on this show. So well done to you, Tay. You have just earned a complete pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier and a T-shirt. So do me a favor and send me a message on Facebook. You know how to do that. And give me your T-shirt size and give me your physical mailing address, and we will put that in the mail to you. And thank you very much for taking our constitutional quiz.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to listen to your show.
I'm honored, and I'm sure Emily is too. Thank you, Emily.
Thanks, Stuart.
And what's your tagline?
We're still signing off with the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to James Lowen, the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, as well as a number of other books that we've discussed on this show previously. So once again, please go to our podcast site. Enter Lowen in the search bar, that's spelled L-O-E-W-E-N, and you can read, or you can listen to, rather, all of our discussions with James Lowen. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.